This is the second lecture in animal development. We're going to begin with the discussion of cleavage. And I told you the definition of cleavage yesterday. It's simply a succession of rapid cell divisions that happen right after fertilization. And you can kind of think of it as having three stages. The beginning stage, of course, is you've got your zygote, which is your fertilized egg. It's a single cell. And then what happens is that zygote begins dividing. But it begins dividing, however, it doesn't get any bigger. So now you have the same size object. It's just, instead of being one cell, it's a lot of cells. We call that the morula. It's a solid ball of cells. And you can see it in the illustration down here in this slide. And then the third stage, I'll call it the ending of this, is when we get to the blastula. And the blastula is a solid ball of, remember the solid ball of cells is the morula, but eventually the morula will develop a fluid-filled cavity inside, which is called the blastocoele. Can you all say that for me, blastocoele? And so what you end up with is a structure called the blastula with a blastocoele inside of it. And really the great analogy here would be like a water balloon. You know, a water balloon has the, obviously the balloon itself is, it would be represent like the cells, and then the water inside represents the fluid inside of the blastula, which we call, you know, that space is called the blastocoele. Now, like I mentioned, the cell does not grow in size. The size of the blastula at the end of this process is the same size as the original zygote. There's just a lot more cells. One thing that you need to know is these smaller cells now have a name. We call them blastomeres. And just a note on the root. Remember the word mere. Do you remember what the word mere means? What does it mean? Who remembers? Mere. Remember like polymer, right? What? Part or segment. So blastomere is a part or a segment of the blastula. So it's one of the individual cells. Kind of cool. In the next slide, we talk about the rearrangement of the cytoplasm. Now, I told you before that when we talk about embryology, we're going to be jumping around between different organisms. Yesterday, we talked about sea urchins when we talked about fertilization. Right now, we're going to talk about frogs, and we're going to talk about fertilization and the beginning of embryonic development in frogs, because this is where a lot of the original studies were done. And what's interesting about a frog is if you look at the frog, the egg, you'll see that the cytoplasm, and remember the cytoplasm is all that material inside the plasma membrane, it turns out that the distribution of the cytoplasm is not uniform, okay? It turns out that there are nutrient molecules in the cytoplasm, and they consist of the yolk, okay? That's part of the cytoplasm. And they tend to be more dense, and therefore, due to gravity, they accumulate at the bottom of the egg, or the lower half of the egg. And they actually, embryologists have given a name to this. They call it a vegetal part of the organism, or of the zygote, and it's down at the bottom, or we call it the vegetal hemisphere, the lower part of the frog egg. And what's interesting is you can see my picture here, but if you look at the cytoplasm, and particularly what we're going to be looking at in the next couple slides, is the cytoplasm, the outermost part of the cytoplasm is called the cortex. And remember, we talked about this word cortex. It always means outermost. And so the cortex of the cytoplasm in this lower, what we call vegetal hemisphere, is not pigmented, okay? So it's clear. And the upper hemisphere, because in the upper hemisphere, this is where the nucleus is. There's no yolk, no nutrients up here. So we call this hemisphere the animal hemisphere, since this is where the nucleus and polar bodies are located. And if you look at it, you'll see that the outermost layer of the cytoplasm, this cortex, is heavily pigmented. And you can see it right here. Okay? Now, my next slide, what you see is this It turns out that the sperm always enters the frog egg in the animal hemisphere. Now, this makes sense, right? Because if that's where the nucleus is, that's where the sperm should enter because it wants to add its chromosomes to the chromosomes of the egg. So to enter into the vegetal hemisphere would be a real disaster because then you're just in a bunch of yolk, a bunch of nutrients, you know, no good being down there. So the sperm knows to enter in the animal hemisphere up top. But when this occurs, a very interesting thing happens. The cortical cytoplasm, in other words, the cortex of the cytoplasm, not all the cytoplasm, will rotate towards the site of sperm entry. And you can see it here on my illustration. You see the sperm entering on the left, and if you look at the next part of the illustration, you'll see that the entire animal hemisphere, the cortical part, the outermost part, has rotated towards the site of sperm entry. Okay? Now what that does is very interesting. If you look at the illustration, you'll see originally the lower part, the vegetal hemisphere, has a very clear cortical layer. And the animal hemisphere has a very dark pigmented layer. But when you have a rotation of this cortical hemisphere, it turns out that the area directly opposite where the sperm enters is not completely dark like the animal, the part of the cortex of the animal hemisphere, or it's not completely light like the vegetal hemisphere. It's sort of in between. So it's not dark, it's not light, it's gray. And in fact, because of the nature of a sphere, it forms a crescent. And this has been named by embryologists. They call this area on the egg, which is now, you know, becomes a zygote, they call this the gray crescent. Now in the next slide, we learn a little bit about the significance of the gray crescent. It turns out, and this is totally cool, this is really neat, the gray crescent actually establishes the bilateral symmetry of a frog. A frog is just like us, it's bilaterally symmetrical. And what's amazing is once the sperm has entered and the gray crescent is formed, the frog's orientation is completely determined because the very first cleavage is directly through the middle of the gray crescent. And you can see it in my picture here. And furthermore, the gray crescent will become the dorsal part of the frog. That means the back of the frog. Well, that means where the sperm entered is going to become the belly of the frog, and then that orients the animal hemisphere as being the head or the anterior end of the frog. So it's amazing. Before you even have your first cell division, you've already determined, the frog, you know, has already determined how it's going to be oriented in space. It's pretty neat. And I'm sure that whoever, I don't remember which embryologist discovered this, but when they did, I'm sure they were like, wow, that's pretty cool. Okay. One of the things I want to tell you about, just to kind of remind you, I mentioned this yesterday, and I'll remind you again today. We're dealing with a number of different organisms. They were all these famous experimental organisms in embryology. Sea urchins, frogs, and chickens are the three main ones. And so what I want to make you aware of is what I've just described, and I'm going to describe, which is the beginning of cell division, the very early cell division, is different for each of these organisms. So I'm including this illustration. It shows sea urchin, frog, and chick very early development up to what we call the eight cell stage. And you'll notice that the way cell division occurs depends on the distribution of the nutrient, which is the yolk. In the sea urchin, the yolk is evenly distributed. So therefore, the cell division is very regular. By the end of eight-stage cell division, you get eight cells, and they're perfectly all the same for sea urchins. For frogs, it's different. Because there's an unequalness in the frog, there's more yolk at the bottom, there's this animal pole at the top. What happens is you get unequal division of the cells, so the cells at the bottom in the vegetal sphere are larger. The ones at the animal sphere are smaller. And then finally, if you're looking at a chick is very unequal. There's lots of yolk, and there's just a little bit of this animal, you know, I guess you would, I don't know if you'd call it the animal hemisphere, but where the actual division is going to occur. And if you look, this is kind of looking, the way it's oriented, you're looking directly down on the chick embryo. There's sort of this disc of tissue, and that's where the division occurs, right there. And that sort of sits on top of all this yolk. So you can see it's very different depending on what organism you are. I want to talk now about the frog blastula. Okay, so we're back to the frog. And unlike the sea urchin, the frog's blastula is not perfectly spherical. It turns out that the bottom part of the blastula is the vegetal pole, the top part is the animal pole, and you actually see that the blastocoele is in the animal hemisphere. It doesn't completely fill the whole blastula. And so that's kind of interesting. So the greater number of cells is in the vegetal hemisphere, as you can see here. And that's how, that's just how frogs develop. Now, at the bottom, you'll see a really cool picture. This is colored, and we've got three different colors, blue, red, and yellow. And the reason why is because it turns out that embryologists were able to make what we call fate maps. And a fate map is literally what it says. Embryologists were able to determine where each of these cells would eventually go, what kind of tissues they would eventually become. So for instance, these blue colored cells are going to become brain and spinal cord. These yellow cells will become the lining of the digestive tract, let's say. These red cells will become bone and muscle. And embryologists could actually trace where these cells actually go. It's pretty remarkable. I remember, this is kind of funny, when I was taking embryology at UC Davis, I remember there was this, I was in a lecture hall, there was 200 or 300 people in this lecture hall, and back then, this is like 30 years ago, it's amazing, they had, you know, blackboards, but the professor, during this section of the course, would have three or four different colors of chalk to show these different tissues and what they would become. And I remember he told us, you need to buy one of those. I don't know if you've seen these pens. They come in four colors, and you can snap them down. You know what I'm talking about? And it was hilarious, because every time he would be drawing a different colored tissue, you could hear like 200 pens all click together to, you know, because everyone was selecting red, you know? And then, you know, 3 minutes later, he'd, you know, change to yellow, and then we'd all, you know, click, 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 all across the room. You know, it was hilarious. And so during this entire course, it was just like these massive clicks throughout this hour-long lecture, you know, three times a week. It was pretty hilarious. So, but you don't have to do that, because this is all on the web now, and you can just download it. You don't have to take notes. Okay, I want you to read this quote from the next slide. Quote, the most important event in your life is not birth, it's not marriage, it's not death, but gastrulation. Okay? You're like, what? Gastrulation? Well, I really want you to think about that and see if you agree. If you're a biologist, you might agree, because it turns out that during gastrulation, the embryo actually generates huge complexity from what was a very, very simple form to begin with. And a collection of cells that look very similar begin to actually start to take on different cell types, and they'll eventually become all the different tissues in your body. So gastrulation is where some of the most radical change happens in your life. Okay, yeah. Well, it depends. Right. That's a great question. And your question is basically saying, you know, when do cells know their fate? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on what organism you are, because every organism is different. Some organisms, you can wait a long time and remove a cell, and it still hasn't determined its fate. And so they're still totipotent, right? They could become a whole new organism. But some organisms, their fate is determined much earlier. And so it really depends. And so you'd have to specify what organism, at what stage of cell division, and so forth. So it's pretty complicated, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, in my next slide, I want to talk a little bit about gastrulation. And the formation, gastrulation is simply the formation of the gastrula. And the word gastro comes from stomach. Remember we talked about gastric juice? Remember, that's juice in your stomach. It's, you know, hydrochloric acid and so forth. Well, so gastrula refers to stomach. And the the definition of gastrulation is the process by which a group of cells moves inward into the blastula and therefore transforms itself. And so if you look at my picture down here, you see a blastula. This is from, let's say, a sea urchin because it's perfectly symmetrical. And what happens is at some point in its development, some of these cells start to poke in to the blastocoel. And that's called invagination. They start to form actually a brand new cavity. And in fact, the cavity that's already there originally is called the blastocoel. Let's all say that, blastocoel. When these cells start to invaginate, they form a new cavity called the archenteron. Archenteron, can you say that for me? And if you look at the word arch means old. You're probably familiar with archaeology, right? The study of old, you know, civilizations and old things. Enteron refers to stomach, and so it's really the literal definition or derivation, you know, of this word is old stomach. So this is the older primitive, they call it the primitive gut or the primitive stomach. What essentially this will become is the digestive tract, okay? And because this invagination is creating this new cavity, the opening where that invagination occurs has a special name. It's called the blastopore. That's the hole that's now created. Can you all see that? Blastopore. Now, let's think about this. Remember, at the very beginning of this course, we learned about protostomes and deuterostomes. What does protostome mean? Does anyone remember? Yeah. Okay, what? Yeah, but what does the word mean, protostome? Proto and then stome, what? Okay, do you know? First mouth. Proto means first, stome means mouth. And so protostomes are organisms, like you said, that the blastopore will become the mouth, and then the anus will form somewhere else. Now there's a whole other group of organisms called deuterostomes. What does deutero mean? Second. Stome means mouth. So deuterostomes are organisms where the blastopore will be the anus and the mouth forms secondarily somewhere else. Okay? Are we protostomes or deuterostomes? We're deuterostomes. What's the other great phylum that is deuterostomes? Echinodermata. So those are the two, us and Echinodermata. Great. Okay, let's talk about gastrulation in frogs. It turns out that the cells that are located where the gray crescent used to be begin to invaginate. So they're the ones that start to go in and form this blastopore and begin to form this archenteron, okay, this primitive gut. And what happens is, if you can see in my picture down here, that the tissue starts moving down and then it moves into the archenteron. And so it moves over what I call the dorsal lip. It turns out that because this forms where the gray crescent is, and if you remember, the gray crescent is on the dorsal part of the frog, that we call this the dorsal lip of the blastopore. And the way it works is the tissue, the cells, move over that dorsal lip and invaginate in and form a primitive gut, the archenteron. Does that make sense? Okay, that process of moving over the dorsal lip and in is called involution. Can everyone say that for me? Involution. Okay. Now, What's interesting is this. If we go to the next slide, we learn about the three tissue layers. Eventually, as this process starts to occur, this process of gastrulation, you end up with three distinct tissue types: ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm. Let's say those: ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm. And if there's anything you memorize from this lecture, it has got to be this slide. You need to know this backwards, forwards, upside down, because this will be on the test. This will be on the AP exam. It's just stuff you have to know. But it's not hard to remember. The ectoderm is colored blue. It's going to become brain and nervous tissue in the nervous system. That's basically what it becomes. It also becomes all the outermost part of us, like our epidermis, our skin, our hair, the cornea and the lens of the eye, our nails. So basically the way to remember this is the ectoderm is, ecto means outer skin. It's all of our, you know, out, what's on the, you know, outside of us, and also our brain and our spinal cord and our nervous system. That's what ectoderm becomes. Mesoderm, which is colored red here, is going to become the skeletal system, which includes bones, cartilage, tendons. It becomes the muscular, all of our muscles. It becomes the circulatory system. It becomes the excretory system. It becomes the reproductive system. So that red material, the mesoderm, becomes a lot, or mesoderm, mesoderm, however you want to say it. And then endoderm is colored yellow, and now it becomes kind of the lining of a lot of systems. Like it's the lining of the, and we call it the epithelial lining, which is one thin layer of cells. The epithelial lining of the digestive tract, the epithelial lining of the respiratory system, the epithelial lining of the reproductive system. It becomes the urethra, the urinary bladder, and three really important organs, the liver, the pancreas, and the thyroid. You need to know this, okay? Because these are super important tissues, right? You need to know where they come from. Finally, we're going to talk about organogenesis, which is, you know, exactly what it sounds like. It's the creation of organs. And what happens is we call it cell differentiation. In other words, cells originally kind of all look the same, but over time they start to differentiate. They start to become different tissues and then eventually different organs. And I want to talk briefly in this one slide about what we call neurulation. And we're going to talk about it in chordates. We are a chordate. So this is what happens in us when we were in the womb. It's kind of cool. And neurulation is the formation of the nervous system. And this was actually a question on the AP exam, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. So it's worth noting. First of all, the notochord. It turns out that if you look, here's a cross-section in my picture of a very primitive chordate. Could be us, right? And the red is the mesoderm. And in the mesoderm, up at the top here, are cells that will eventually become the notochord. They're along the dorsal surface, which means the back. And the notochord sort of forms a stiff rod. And it, you know, provides sort of a structure for the organism. Nearby the mesoderm will actually become the vertebral column. And, you know, basically our entire back is the bone in our back are these vertebrae. And that's what this red, some of this red mesoderm will become. Okay, provides the structure. Now, right above it, you'll see some ectoderm that's been colored green here. It's still ectoderm, but what they're trying to emphasize is that this particular ectoderm is going to become the nervous system. And it starts off it sort of goes through this stepwise process. It starts off as what they call a neural plate, and then with a slight fold in it, they call it the neural fold, and over time that neural plate and neural fold will sort of come up on itself, as you can see. It'll eventually form what we call a neural groove. Eventually, that neural groove will completely come in on itself and form a neural tube. So you go from neural plate to neural fold to neural groove to neural tube. And then that neural tube will end up becoming the spinal cord and the brain. Now, here's what surprises students, because a lot of you don't know this. inside of our spinal cord, in the middle of it, there is a hollowness. Now, it may, and that's because it was formed from a neural tube, but most of it's the cells just grow close together. It's still there, but not very evident, okay? But what does end up happening is in the brain, this neural tube, there will be spaces inside the brain that are the remnant of this neural tube. They're called the ventricles. I don't know if you remember when we looked at the brain, if you remember that, but that neural tube really becomes the ventricles. And the ventricles are full of a special fluid that can flow through the ventricles. Does anyone know what it's called? That's a neurotransmitter. It's called cerebral spinal fluid. You guys heard of that? Okay, so it's this fluid that moves through the brain and down into the spinal cord. And you may have heard of people getting a spinal tap. That's when they put a big needle in your back and they suck out some of this fluid to test for various things. So it's an important fluid. Okay, I want to talk about a couple of experiments that are sort of classic that you need to know about. Back about 100 years ago was a guy named Hans Spemann. And what he did is he asked this question, can a nucleus remain totipotent? In other words, can a nucleus remain capable of directing the development of a complete embryo, you know, during cleavage and blastular formation? So what he did was very clever. He was using frog embryos, and he bisected a frog zygote, actually. This is a zygote, the very first cell, right? Fertilized egg. He bisected a frog zygote with a loop that he formed from a single baby hair. And he did it in two ways. In my picture, you can see that in one case, he completely bisected the gray crescent, and then he took those two cells and he saw what happened. And lo and behold, he got two normal frogs that developed from those two, that original bisected cell and zygote. He also took it, and this time he bisected it, but this time all of the gray crescent was in one half and it wasn't in the other half. And when he did that, what you ended up getting, you got a normal frog from the part that had the gray crescent and then this belly piece from the part that didn't. And so in my next slide, you know, we sort of come to a conclusion that what he concluded was that the cytoplasmic material, the material in the cytoplasm, is somehow unevenly distributed in the zygote, and that certain substances in the cytoplasm, what he called cytoplasmic determinants, are necessary for proper development. Now, what these are today, I'm not up on the latest embryology. I bet these are some kind of proteins. That's probably what they are, right? And if a cell does not have these cytoplasmic determinants, they cannot proceed to develop in a proper fashion. So in particular, the frog needs cytoplasmic determinants from the gray crescent for normal development. If you don't have it, you don't get normal development. So it's a pretty cool experiment. Now, another very famous experiment was also done by Spemann and Mangold in 1924. And the question they ask is, can some cells induce other cells to follow a particular developmental path? You know, they didn't know. So what they did is they transplanted the dorsal lip of the blastopore from a non-pigmented frog gastrula to a new location on a pigmented frog gastrula. Now, the reason they picked a non-pigmented and a pigmented is so they could distinguish the two different kinds of tissues, because they would see whatever was light-colored must have come from, you know, one, and the dark color came from the other. And you can see here in my picture, the light-colored one, the non-pigmented, was the dorsal lip was transmitted to the backside of a pigmented frog gastrula. And over time, they ended up getting was actually two embryos. And it turned out that the recipient embryo formed a second notochord and a neural tube in the region of the transplant, and eventually almost developed a complete second embryo. So the conclusion from this experiment was for some reason, the dorsal lip of the blastopore was capable of inducing the formation of an embryo. pretty darned amazing. And so what they decided, okay, this dorsal lip of the blastopore we are going to call, quote, the primary embryonic organizer. It is really this special tissue that organizes everything. And that's a really powerful idea that they came up with. Okay, and that's it for today.